a lot of us are really familiar with like style or factor investing. So whether it's momentum or value or small cap stocks, that's very much like an academic source of return premium in your portfolio. Whereas flow driven, kind of these structural alpha opportunities are another source of alpha in a portfolio that, again, historically has only been available to institutional investors. And what I think it provides the industry at large through the use of derivatives is more targeted outcomes and more of a risk mitigation approach. So a lot of what we talk about from just the volatility we've seen over the last several months is thinking about tail risk hedging. So you can go out, you can buy a long duration treasury bond that I think historically has been a kind of a key lever for tail risk hedging in a balanced portfolio, but it takes up a lot of capital in your portfolio. If you want to have a decent size hedge, you're buying maybe 10-15% of your portfolio in a long duration treasury. It's not super exciting. And then you have to sit there and wait for that to play out. So through derivatives, you can be more capital efficient. I hate to use the word leverage because that always has this negative connotation, but leverage is actually a beneficial thing when it comes to thinking about building a balanced portfolio and being capital efficient, freeing up your capital, your clients' capital to put towards, you know, the return drivers, the growth drivers, and then you can have less in this kind of alternative risk mitigating bucket as a result of that.
Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Director at AdvisorAnalyst.com. Joining me is Paisley Nardini, Portfolio Manager and Multi-Asset Strategist at Simplify Asset Management.
This is the Insight is Capital podcast.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Paisley, welcome and thank you so much for being here. It's great to have you.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Really looking forward to our conversation. First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what your role is at Simplify.
Yeah, so I'll try to keep the background short. But I'll start by saying I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in northern Minnesota and actually had the opportunity to be a part of a really amazing program, very experiential learning focused at the University of Minnesota, in which we were managing part of the endowment through a financial markets program. So you can kind of see I've been in the industry really since I started in college, and that really drove my fascination through analytics and research and fundamental analysis. So fast forward, I was graduating from college, again, northern Minnesota, and was just really seeking the best opportunity I could find in the industry, which brought me out to California at the time, which was pretty scary. I grew up very rural Minnesota, moved to San Francisco, which is very much different change of pace. And I think what was interesting as well is my program in college was all equity focused. So stock selection, we were like sector analysts. And I think a lot of the education within kind of undergraduate programs is focused on equities. It's a more sexy part of the portfolio, higher returns, more tangible in the sense you like when you walk into a Whole Foods and then you can buy the stock of Whole Foods. I just think that resonates more.
All right.
So I really had no desire to enter the world of fixed income. But lo and behold, my first opportunity landed me on a short duration fixed income desk, which at the time it was 2011. Rates were zero. So it was a really interesting, I went from being like a sector focused analyst in this program to trading essentially zero overnight rates for repo and T-bills and short duration agencies. So it really felt at the time that I would like kind of got this not bummer of a job, but I was like, wait, this isn't sexy. This isn't exciting. But what it taught me, and I think is really helpful, and I share this with a lot of the students that I mentor now, is the world of fixed income is fascinating, right? It's driven a lot by macroeconomics and the importance of economic data. I mean, even today we saw some prints in inflation and consumer spending. Like all of this drives kind of that greater ethos of what we do on a daily basis in this industry. So long story short, spent a couple of years on a fixed income trading desk. And then just realized that I was kind of pigeonholing myself from the bigger picture again is being out in front of clients, understanding what matters to the end client, because you can fight for a basis point, you can fight for a, you know, slightly cheaper entry price and some of your security selection. But at the end of the day, that doesn't really matter to our end clients. The bigger picture does. So I decided to migrate off the trading desk and enter more of a client-facing sales role, which brought me to PIMCO, which was super exciting. I mean, just to be surrounded by just some of the brightest minds in the business, in the industry, combined with people that have this like next level work ethic. Every single day you show up and you say, what can we be doing better? What can we be doing more of? And zero complacency whatsoever in that type of environment, which was really fascinating to be able to soak in and experience. And I think at that juncture in my career, I then had the experience of, you know, portfolio management and trading, client-facing skill set. And for me, I loved both of them in equal proportions, which is really how I've spent the last 8 or 9 years of my career now, is focused on that kind of middle ground. What can be called a strategist or a client portfolio manager is understanding both sides of the business and then being able to articulate that to our clients. So for the last, like I said, 8 or so years, have been in this multi-asset role where I'm helping advisors, I'm helping institutional clients think about asset allocation, objective-based investing. How can we think about specific outcomes and then tailor the portfolio allocations to meet those? And it's been super fun. So I joined Simplify Asset Management about 5 or 6 months ago, and it's really my first venture into more of the startup world. I've always worked at really large firms, Invesco, PIMCO, Wells Fargo. But now I'm in this environment where every day we have the latitude to be creative and really think about like how we can solve problems for our clients and do so in a really expedited fashion, because we don't have all this bureaucratic red tape. So the ability to launch new products and engage with our clients has been super exciting.
Yeah, and it's a super exciting time as well in the market, especially in the ETF space. And there's been a number of rule changes in the last number of years. And it's interesting to hear about your role, first of all, but one of the big problems is the knowledge transfer problem. You know, there's this gap in knowledge between what practitioners are doing, such as at your firm and at the firms you've been at. Bringing solutions to market is one thing, and actually innovating something that will have the desired impact on a portfolio as a diversifier or as an allocation. But it's a whole other thing to be able to read the tea leaves and then transfer that knowledge to the advisor so that they can use it in their, you know, to fill the knowledge gap between them and their end client.
Absolutely.
And having them be able to understand it and have the confidence to move forward and put a solution on their shelf for the long term. And so that must be a lot of fun. I mean, it must be very gratifying for you. Right.
I've realized over the years, that's one of my favorite parts of this job. And irrespective of what firm I'm at, the ability to educate, whether it's my peers, and again, likewise, receiving education from my peers, but being able to then take that knowledge, transfer it. And I do think that you hit the nail on the head. We can come out with really innovative solutions and products, and, you know, the name of our firm, Simplify, we're trying to simplify some of the more complex. I joke that the name Complexify was taken. That's why we chose Simplify. But it is. It's a very important part of the piece to delivering a good experience to our advisor clients and ultimately their end client is the understanding of not only how these solutions or strategies work, because sometimes people don't want too much of the insight, you know, how the sausage is made sometimes is too much information. But at a minimum is understanding like when these strategies will work, when they might hit, you know, a roadblock, what the expectations are when you invest in these, because that's ultimately what it is in this industry, like any industry, it's communication and it's expectation. So if we can provide that education to our advisor clients to help them support the conversations they're having on a daily basis, they're going to be much more confident allocating to our strategies. Again, they might not know all of the inner workings. It's not necessarily always their job. That's our job.
Right.
But if we can give them a roadmap of how to put this in the portfolio, the position sizing is also very important, right? You can have a strategy that takes on greater amounts of active risk and has potentially greater upside, but it's all about how you put it in the portfolio. A 3% allocation versus a 30% allocation is really kind of the difference in setting you up for success or failure. So kind of going back to the bigger picture, again, education, I think, is so vital, and the communication of that as well. And we can talk about this later, but part of what I do in kind of my extracurricular time is mentorship for undergrad students. I live in Orange County, California, and so we have a university program where they get to actually go in, manage a real multi-asset portfolio. It's real money behind this. They make investment decisions. And again, just being able to transfer that skill set to set people up for success, I think that's what it's all about.
Yeah, and that sounds amazing. That too must be gratifying. There's been, you know, like since 2020, there has been a proliferation of new innovative ETFs coming into the market, including from Simplify.
Correct.
That are designed to provide more avenues for investors seeking less correlated or uncorrelated diversifiers to traditional stock bond portfolios. And at the same time, there's also been, like, because there's this weird dichotomy in the market, there's also been a flurry of launches of more speculative ETFs, mm-hmm. like index and individual stock ETFs with double and triple exposure, for example, which kind of, they seem to be in two separate, you know, like the parting of the Red Sea. They seem to be one group of diversifying solutions is on one side, and then on the other side is all these new speculative, highly speculative in some cases, ETFs. So there's a lot of noise, right? What are your thoughts on this, and how should advisors and investors alike think about weighting or filtering through all of it?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking that question. Again, setting ourselves up for success. I mean, just to backtrack a little bit, your acknowledgement of the proliferation of these products coming to market around kind of the 2020 time period corresponds to a rule change. It's 18F4 rule that allows for the use of derivatives more widely within ETF vehicles. So that's why, just for the broader listener here, if they're unaware of that rule, that's kind of coincides then with this time frame. And that's ultimately why Simplify came to market as well. We saw this opportunity that we could now bring alternative diversified sources of risk and return in an institutional fashion that historically was only available in more of the separate account space or more of the hedge fund space. So with opportunity then comes the extreme, right? Like anything in the world, the pendulum swings. And there's been a lot of strategies, ETFs that have come to market given this. I think some of those, like in, I'm glad you mentioned this as well, is that dichotomy and like really looking at what's coming to market as maybe an opportunity to bring historically institutional hedge fund strategies to a broader array of clients.
Right.
For the purpose of diversification, for the purpose of risk mitigation, for the purpose of enhancing returns through a risk-aware lens. And then what's coming to market that starts to look more kind of like the meme stock craze, where it's more of the retail-driven flows, looking at kind of those outsized returns in a really short period of time. And from what I've seen, and I meet with advisors on a daily basis, it's very rare that I'm encountering advisors that are utilizing these more kind of like frenzy meme levered stocks in their client portfolios. I do think that, which is a good thing, this has been more segmented to the retail industry that's using these. But what that means then is, like you said, oftentimes that can be clouded because our strategies that have come to market for the purpose of being more institutional are getting clouded with this kind of retail tailwind. But from our perspective, a lot of these strategies have been in existence for decades. I mean, a big part of what we do here at Simplify through the use of derivatives is what made PIMCO famous as like the bond behemoth. It's what we call structural alpha. And, you know, if you think about, I like to, just from an education perspective, a lot of us are really familiar with like style or factor investing. So whether it's momentum or value or small cap stocks, that's very much like an academic source of return premium in a portfolio. Whereas flow-driven, kind of these structural alpha opportunities are another source of alpha in a portfolio that, again, historically has only been available to institutional investors. And what I think it provides, not just Simplify, but the industry at large through the use of derivatives, is more targeted outcomes and more of a risk mitigation approach. So a lot of what we talk about from just the volatility we've seen over the last several months is thinking about tail risk hedging. So you can go out, you can buy a long duration treasury bond that I think historically has been a kind of a key lever for tail risk hedging in a balanced portfolio, but it takes up a lot of capital in your portfolio. If you want to have a decent size hedge, you're buying maybe 10-15% of your portfolio in a long duration treasury. It's not super exciting. And then you have to sit there and wait for that to play out. So through derivatives, you can be more capital efficient. I hate to use the word leverage because that always has this negative connotation, but leverage is actually a beneficial thing when it comes to thinking about building a balanced portfolio and being capital efficient, freeing up your capital, your client's capital to put towards, you know, the return drivers, the growth drivers, and then you can have less in this kind of alternative risk mitigating bucket as a result of that. So again, this goes back to the educational piece of this. But I think the enhancement and the proliferation of this part of the market is really institutionalizing the advisor community's access to investment strategies. And I think it's just, it's naturally where the industry is headed. I think over the last 5 or 10 years, we've seen advisors start to lean on technology to enhance their daily practice, as well as through support from a lot of the large asset managers for portfolio construction advice, model build out. I think that's another way the industry has started to institutionalize their practice. And then this is kind of this the next step in that ladder to help build better, more rounded institutional portfolios.
Yeah, it's interesting because looking back on the last, 10 or 15 years, you have two large groups of investors, those who were already in the market in equities and bonds and did extremely well from 2010 till last year, this year even, up till now, although I don't think you can say that about long duration bonds because that's been quite a ride for the last year and a half. But
I'm glad you bring that up.
But yeah. And as you hold that thought and, but the dichotomy is interesting because it seems now that the stock market has been testing this, like the S&P 500 testing 6,000 as this high watermark for the last, I don't know how many months, since at least the new administration was confirmed. And, you look at that and you think like that's happening. And at the same time, we've got all these growth drivers in the economy, which were driving bond yields higher and higher. At the 10 years plus, the TLT, for example, into the longer term duration. So it and I'm kind of trying to lead up to your outlook because I want to ask you about that. But when you look at the dichotomy, there's the investors who have benefited largely over the last decade plus from strong equity and strong bond markets. And now that group, that cohort of investors is in, that one side of the parting of the Red Sea, which is like, I want to keep what I earned. I want to keep what I got out of the market the last 10, 15 years. And then on the other side is the FOMO category, which is like, wow, how did I miss that? How did I miss the equity market? How did I miss the bond market? How did I miss Nvidia? How did I miss Bitcoin? How did I miss all these incredible return opportunities? I was too busy either being worried about the market or being worried about the economy or my job or whatever. If you're talking about younger investors or first time new investors coming into the market and appified investors, it seems that, one group of issuers in the marketplace is really trying to fill that need for diversifiers. And other group of issuers in the market is trying to fulfill that FOMO.
Yeah.
Right. So you've got, there's a lot of noise. I mean, and the market's very noisy right now because of all the chaos that's happening. Diversification appeals to one group very solidly, which is the beneficiaries of all the strength in the market. the last decade, the return, you know, the return of the S&P 500, just for starters. But it doesn't appeal to the other cohort, the, you know, the FOMO, watching the market, you know, reach new highs the last year again and again and again and test. And then, so one group is interested in diversification, one group isn't.
And right? My thoughts on that is the group that is not interested in diversification is the group that's looking in the rearview mirror.
Yeah.
The group that is interested in diversifying their portfolios and ultimately not only diversifying, locking in those gains that you mentioned, right? We've had some outsized years for asset class returns. And most of, if you've been in the market, even if you've been slightly diversified, if you've been in the market, most of your clients are likely sitting on meaningful gains. The big topic for the last 2 years is there's been no tax loss harvesting at the end of the year because everything's up. Obviously, long bonds is the one exception, as you highlight. But I think those that are afraid of diversifying, again, whether we call it FOMO or just really looking in the rearview mirror, are people that are acknowledging that diversification has been a thorn in the side of a balanced portfolio.
Right.
And that has been the case really since post-GFC. My thoughts around that are that, you know, we had this environment where monetary policy was suppressing volatility in the market. Rates were extremely low. It made sense to lever up, to take risk, and markets reflect that. It really wasn't until mid-2022 when interest rates broadly started to increase, and that brought the hammer down on what historically has been the ballast in most advisors' portfolios, and whether that's long bonds or even intermediate bonds, anything with duration component since 2022 has not served clients well. And we can come back and even talk about what that means.
And it's that interest rate risk, right?
It's interest rate risk.
Yeah.
And
that's 90% of a 60-40 portfolio is equity or interest or economic risk.
I
was just going to say that you know, one of the interesting parts of, you know, diversification is like, you know, like for the other dichotomy, like the parting of the Red Sea is the difference between advised clients who are working with advisors on, you know, their investment plans, their financial plans. And the other cohort on the other side of the Red Sea parting is unadvised, mostly unadvised, maybe DIY investors who are seeing, oh, you know, I can buy this ETF through my phone, right? And you know, that sounds like a great idea. I can get a 3x exposure to Nvidia. That stock is crazy. You know, like, so you have two different kinds of investors. But then I think, you know, because our audience is advisors, I think the diversification, obviously the diversification conversation is the most relevant conversation. But advisors, you know, still have to deal with their clients in the sense that the clients, maybe the advisors aren't prone to the speculative fervor, you know, the frothiness of the market and the FOMO, the feeling of FOMO, but they still have to often deal with their end clients' impulses.
Yep.
And try to put that, you know, no, I don't think the 3X NVIDIA play is really a good idea unless, you know, if you want to play with play money somewhere else,
carve out a little bucket.
You know, but I don't want to make that part of your overarching plan here that we've tried to establish all this time in our relationship. I think so that's the problem advisors have, and the problem advisors perennially have is you know, why did we buy this diversifier when all it did was put a drag on my portfolio?
It's
always having to say you're sorry, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Diversification.
Always having to say you're sorry. And it's also the expectation. And I think a lot of times, too, our end clients, their benchmark changes based on who they hung out with that week or what they saw on TV that week or, you know, what CNBC or Bloomberg were telling us was like the hot sector or the hot stock that week. So, again, like going back to that educational component is like the advisor kind of underpinning the conversation on asset allocation with their clients to the fact that you can't compare a portfolio that's not 100% stocks to the ACWI or to the S&P. It's not a fair benchmark. But ultimately, I think you're right, is it's a really difficult conversation to have with a lot of end clients in that diversification story. But I think, again, if the advisor can shift the narrative, focusing on those meaningful gains and profit that they've achieved for their clients, it's almost like, you know, you're at the casino, you're at the craps table, you're up at the end of the night. It's like, take your winnings, call it a night kind of thing. And I think that's where we are in the cycle today. And I had shared with you before we chatted today, is kind of my theme right now is like riding this edge of chaos where there's so much uncertainty in an environment with heightened uncertainty, elevated volatility. It doesn't behoove investors to take really high conviction bets. And I say that again, meeting with advisors every week. I've met with advisors over the last, you know, couple weeks, and especially from an interest rate volatility perspective, you have like two sides of the card. You have some advisors that are saying like, you know, the 10-year and the US 10-year is headed for 2%, and what's increased duration meaningfully. And then you have other advisors that are saying higher for longer. We don't want any duration in our portfolio. I think the, you know, rates are going to back up another 50, 100 basis points over the next couple months with some sticky inflation prints. And you can kind of see both ends of the spectrum. And again, maybe I'm boring, but I think at the end of the day...
A month ago, it was very attractive to look at the long duration bonds because they were pushing up to, you know, 4.6, 4.7, 4.8, like... That was an unusual, you know, that's an unusual thing. But if you owned the duration bonds, it was, you know, it was suffered, like pure suffering, because it's like, oh, you know, why did I do this? You know, and then, you know, since that time, and just in the last couple of weeks, bond yields have, you know, the 10-year has receded to what, 4.25?
Yeah.
Something like just yesterday. Yep. And so when you see that, and then we're also in the midst of this correction in equities as well this week. So right about now, everybody who didn't have diversification in their portfolio, either in the form of long duration bonds or some kind of hedge against equity or absolute return or some kind of long short strategy or uncorrelated strategy in their portfolios, thinking like, I'm totally exposed. Other than the fact
out again, going back to the FOMO, it's like just when you think you figured it out, you missed out again. But I think the prudent thing, not only at this stage of the cycle, but throughout the cycle again, is thinking about the preservation of capital, thinking about those long term investment objectives. And how do you balance a portfolio? Like I said, maybe call it boring, but I think the high conviction bets for your end client's portfolio and like a balanced approach doesn't serve you well, because you have to get the call right. And if you get the call right on a macro perspective of getting your clients in and out of the market, maybe you shouldn't be an advisor. Maybe you should be managing money, right? So I think it's just, you have too much to worry about in your day. Making high conviction calls is generally not the best use of your time for your clients. But I think the way to do that is, like, again, looking through the noise. I think what we're experiencing already and what we're likely to experience over the next several months are these acute bouts of volatility. You know, I think everybody is always so tethered to the 08 financial crisis because that's, you know, You're seared in our brains of this like long prolonged 50% drawdown. I think just how fast the markets move, trading activity, some of this kind of retail mania as well. I just think that there's these shorter bouts of volatility, which are sharp, severe corrections. And I think the way to navigate that is by being diversified, by having active management, which I know puts like a bad taste in a lot of people's mouth after a decade of like passive being king. Why on earth are we going to pay higher fees for active management? It hasn't worked. Well, there's this new era of active management. We started our conversation today talking about these new strategies and solutions that are institutionally driven. And it's no knock on like the traditional fundamental, like discretionary active stock picking manager. But active doesn't have to mean like there's a person sitting at a desk making holes, right? It can be this structural source of alpha. It can be tail risk hedging. And I think having some of these strategies within a portfolio allows you to put your head on a pillow at night and not worry that if, you know, the 10-year backs up to 5.5 tomorrow or goes to 3.5, either direction, like you're going to feel confident that you're still aligned for those long-term objectives for your clients.
Yeah.
So that's how we think about it.
Yeah. Let's talk about your outlook, your latest outlook. You described the market as riding the edge of chaos. I love that.
Yeah.
I didn't want it to be too boring. Yeah. It's like we're walking a tightrope right now with the market, and that's made it, you know, rather hard. And I also like your point, you know, about trying to make a defined bet, because, you know, it brings up the luck skill debate, right? Which is this longstanding debate between, you know, are you lucky and you made money, or was there skill, and what's the proportion of each? You know, there's obviously there's definitely some element of both in every strategy.
Yeah.
But the key is to have a much higher degree of skill rather than luck, so that when these chaotic times that we're facing, that we're coming up against in the next couple of years and longer, are much easier to deal with, and much, you know, being able to build more resilient portfolios to withstand a multitude of scenarios, not just, you know, one scenario or one chaotic or one exogenous event or one. Let's start there. How are things shaping up going forward?
Yeah, so I would start by saying the edge of chaos is a theory that really resonates with me, just given today's backdrop of like this dynamic state of order and disorder. And I think many of us that are watching the news or are plugged in feel this because, you know, macro, geopolitical, monetary policy, like every single day, it seems like we're getting some bit new of information that's pushing markets higher, that's pulling markets lower. And I think, you know, the saying of like, we're skating on thin ice, that's kind of where I feel like we're at right now. There's a lot of uncertainty. And so each bit of data that we get, each bit of news that we get, each insight on whether or not we are going to have tariffs imposed and what that means and at what extent, all of this has this order and disorder component to it every single day. But I think the optimistic side of this, because the edge of chaos sounds doom and gloom, and it's actually not meant to be. With the uncertainty and unpredictability that we have in front of us, there's actually a lot of opportunity that can arise from that, right? So looking at the bigger picture of understanding, we're not likely in an environment where like markets are just going to go straight up over the next 6 to 12 months. There's just so much uncertainty. We came into this year as well with very lofty expectations on growth. And I think if we take a step back after 2022, when both stocks and bonds got beat up, then all of a sudden everybody's bearish, right? It's always after the fact, which is fair. In hindsight's 2020. But we had really low expectations for 2023 and 2024 in regards to GDP growth, in regards to earnings growth. And so the market continually underpriced the upside potential. And it's usually when markets are on the other side that the opportunity kind of escapes us, right? So 2023 and 2024 were really strong years that every year we went in, everybody's like, yeah, this is going to be the year. Here's the recession. It's coming.
Yeah.
If you looked at headlines in October of 2022, there was like 100% chance of recession call out there in the marketplace.
Right.
So back to your point earlier of that.
Yeah, with that inverted yield curve argument that was, you know, Cam Barbie's inverted yield curve.
No, at this point, the curve inverted, uninverted, now reinverted. So I was like, maybe this isn't the best indicator.
Yeah.
But my point being is that market has finally caught up to what's actually occurred over the last 2 years is really attractive, strong, consistent growth. And so now that we're entering 2025, the marketplace is like, hey, like, we're good, like, let's do this. And so ultimately what that means is expectation versus now where we need to come in to beat these expectations. Like, that bar has consistently been raised over the last 2 years. That makes it really difficult, really challenging backdrop to actually over-deliver. And we've already started to see that with many of the earnings reports that have come out in just the last month here, is when these corporations are beating, the market's not really rewarding them, right? Like, right. Oh, sales growth was, you know, slightly above estimates. The market's like, yeah, okay, but not great enough. So like, even sometimes these stocks have been down after a positive earnings report. Obviously NVIDIA earnings this past week, you know, the market through options was really pricing in some really big swings, or like plus or minus 10%, either rally or sell out post NVIDIA earnings. And again, like pretty flat. So I think what that means again is like, we need to take a step back and understand that we mispriced or underpriced the opportunity for upside. And now we want to reprice it and say, okay, finally, I get it. All right, market, like you have something to show us.
Yeah.
Well, now it's, I don't want to say it's too late, because that makes it sound like I think equities are going to sell off meaningfully this year. We're due for a correction. We've started to see this. There's been a rotation. And I think too, if you take a look at just over the last month or so, a lot of the downside in equities has been concentrated in, you know, I don't know if we're still calling it the Magnificent Seven, but a lot of that, yeah, so the Magnificent Seven, the FANG stocks, we keep renaming them, but a lot of that has been focused within those kind of lofty high flyers that have pulled the market up over the last 2 years. So I think it's healthy to see some of these coming back down to earth. And if you look at the rest of the market, the other, you know, in the S&P 500, the other 493 stocks, they've actually done decently well. I think there's been this conversation in just the last couple of weeks about how international stocks, you know, are finally getting their groove back. The rest of the S&P 500 has actually kept up pretty well. It's a little bit of dollar weakness that has supported some international stocks. This all goes back to the bigger picture of, you don't need to get out of the market because of where we are. You need to diversify across the market. So it's moving out of these kind of market cap, again, active versus passive at this point.
Right.
And so I think there's a lot of opportunity, again, going back to that, you know, the edge of chaos is things aren't going to necessarily be comfortable over the next couple months, but that doesn't mean that you can't capitalize on kind of the shifting narrative and take advantage of capturing some of these pockets where they're kind of due for a bit of a rally.
So what are some of these pockets that you like?
Yeah. So I would say bigger picture, I think there's a big opportunity in the alternatives sleeve. And I know that's a broad term, but really looking beyond traditional equity and fixed income beta. So let's take a step back. Equity and credit are really priced for perfection. We've obviously seen that pull back a little bit in the last few weeks. Credit spreads have come out a little bit, not a ton. Equity is kind of plateaued a bit. So how can we think about bringing in additional sources of risk and return premium to the portfolio? As I say this, commodities have also had a bit of a sell-off in the last few weeks here with some growth concerns, with tariff concerns. But I do think hard assets are ripe for tailwinds in the year ahead. If tariffs come to fruition in the sense that we think, that ultimately prices a lot of these commodities higher. If inflation continues to show that it is sticky in some sense, which my personal opinion, I think the trajectory on inflation is headed downward, which is, you know, what the Fed wants. But I do think there's some lingering activity there that could support commodity prices, and just a lot of the volatility in markets from like a geopolitical sense. And like I said, tariffs as well. So I think some of the hard asset opportunity, obviously gold has been a very large beneficiary of that. Especially within the last couple weeks here, some of the dollar weakness. But I also think too, is like being dynamic in these sectors where there is still remains that uncertainty, right? Everything I just outlined is me saying, well, we could have tariffs. We might not. We might have inflation. We might not.
That's kind of where we are though, right?
Exactly.
Is always the state of not having, you know, a concrete idea of anything.
Like, yeah. So I think if you
ground is constantly shifting,
I think the macro tailwinds for hard assets are there, but I think in order to capitalize on that, you have to be dynamic. And so at Simplify, the way that we think about commodities is being able to be long or short at any given time. And I think that provides opportunity as well. I would say another factor for commodities, which is less about the current political or tariff policy landscape, is really just the shifting weather patterns. And this also actually is meant to be apolitical. I don't like to use the word climate change when I talk about this, because instantly, you know, it becomes political. But there's no arguing that certain commodities have seen tailwinds because of reduced supply because of weather related conditions. So cocoa was up like 200-300% last year. That's because where most of the cocoa is sourced from is in parts of Africa that have been exposed to extreme droughts over the last few years. Coffee prices, same thing. Weather-related conditions creating supply shocks, driving up prices. So there's a lot of opportunity just given shifting weather patterns as well. Increased flooding, fires, all of this can have direct impact on the commodity sector. And so that's one kind of side pocket, I think, from a tailwind perspective that also leads us to want to be more dynamic in the commodity space. I would also say, too, kind of shifting gears, other opportunities that we see today, again, is really just being active, thinking about tail risk hedging, thinking about alternative sources of return premium in the portfolio. And I spoke earlier about the difference between kind of academic versus structural return premia. And so through the use of options, being able to have more defined outcomes within the marketplace, thinking about more objective-based investing, and thinking about like how to cut those tails if we do have market drawdowns in the portfolio to preserve kind of some of those gains. And then ultimately,
Paisley, it's interesting how you separate the academic from the structural. Like I have to admit, it took me some time to understand the difference. And like, you know, sometimes when you look at a portfolio, you know, you'll think about diversifying broadly across all these different equity, you know, segments.
Yep.
In particular factors, right?
Yep.
But that's not giving any breadth to the portfolio. It's just giving more depth.
Correct.
And so while you may think, okay, I'm going to do geographical diversification, I'm going to do factor diversification, I'm going to do all these different types of diversification, you're still exposed.
Yes, beta.
You're still exposed to beta. You're still exposed to the interest rate sensitivity of those markets. You're still exposed to all that regular equity risk by doing that. You're not actually taking part of your portfolio and giving it more breadth into some of the absolute return areas, which are the structural areas where you can achieve a structural correlation to, you know, like the idea is to kind of get into a position where you avoid a situation where all correlations go to one. Well, if there's parts of your portfolio that are structurally uncorrelated or low correlation or, you know, then you're going to achieve that diversification that you're actually the true diversification.
Yeah. I mean, this is like a silly analogy, but I think about, like you said, is like thinking about like sector diversification within equities. It's like me deciding to wear like a blue turtleneck versus a black one. It's the same thing, right? So if you can think about like true diversified sources of risk.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
It's still a turtleneck.
But like, it also relates to fixed income. Like you said, is like fixed income, there's a lot of volatility in interest rates. Credit spreads are priced for perfection. So how do you stay allocated to fixed income in a diversified way? It's through convexity. And so a big part of what we do here at Simplify is thinking about the use of options within our fixed income strategies. And when we don't find value in either kind of the duration call or the credit call, which is really where we're at today. And again, kind of reducing those high conviction bets that can be, you know, prone to meaningful swings and market sell-off. So convexity within fixed income, I think another area that's really interesting right now, just given more of the political backdrop, is currencies. That's an area where you can absolutely deliver uncorrelated sources of attractive absolute return. And what we're seeing globally right now is a lot of divergence in interest rate policy. Central banks are starting to kind of drift away from each other after, you know, several years of everybody kind of being in line. So I think that supports an opportunity to take advantage of some of those shifting dynamics as well. So there's a lot of opportunity.
All the uncertainty, like the White House is fomenting all this chaos and uncertainty and geopolitically, especially more, you know, it's only been a month. It's been a month and you know, it seems like everything is being turned upside down and you've got this everyone for themselves situation happening where, as you said, the central banks are no longer, you know, unified on anything. We're going to look out for ourselves. We're going to make policy decisions that benefit us.
Yeah.
We're not going to worry about, you know, how that benefits or disadvantages the other, our other trading partners. We're just going to look after ourselves now. And that's the unfortunate weird part that all this chaos has bred.
And I would say, to like, as we think about exactly to that point,
but it's an opportunity, right?
Opportunity. Yeah. It started to result in a bit of that kind of like deglobalization, right? Mm-hmm. I feel like over the last several decades, it's been this focus on like, how do we globalize? How do we increase our trading partners? How do we reduce costs? That's been very deflationary for asset classes broadly. So whether this is the catalyst or kind of the initial stages of that deglobalization, that's another kind of tailwind for inflation sticking around. So again, are we in the midst of like kind of the shifting guards and a shifting regime? I think we absolutely could be. I still think a lot of uncertainty exists, so I'm not piling in on that trade. But enough is kind of put in front of us right now that, again, going back to the thought of there's opportunity in chaos, thinking about... If we continue to encounter these acute bouts of volatility, like how can active management, again, doesn't have to be discretionary, it can be systematic active, play a role in our portfolios? And I truly think that diversification is back. I do think that, you know, I'm not saying sell all your passive management. I'm not saying like get out of equities. Absolutely not. But I do think portfolios will benefit from having some more of these institutional type investment strategies that allow diversification, that allow you to prudently think about staying in the market, locking in some of those profits. And again, stock bond correlations have not served us well over the last couple of years. Maybe that changes meaningfully in the next 6 months. But for the time being, I think we need to think beyond just a stock bond portfolio when we're supporting our clients.
Given that, how should advisors and investors, I think a lot of advisors might actually be like in that mindset right now, you know, thinking I gotta do something more if I haven't already done it. I think there's a lot of advisors who have begun to make these gradual changes to their clients' portfolios and to their practice. But it might not have been enough or significant enough yet because of the long runway that it takes to do that. But also there's the long runway is due to the gap, right? I just have the distinct feeling that, you know, like, especially, you know, if you get into the upper tiers of net worth, client size, the desire to preserve wealth rather than to just simply grow it. You want to continue to grow your wealth, but you also want to make sure that you put the strategies in place to preserve it. I feel like, you know, even though there's this knowledge gap, advisors and clients are on board. It's just making the move to make it happen and seeing it through is the hard part. Changing your investment policy statements and things like that are going to, you know, are the big hurdles. It seems to be more of the, you know, a lot of bureaucratic or compliance hurdles that need to be satisfied before you can actually start making wholesale changes. And maybe that's where ETFs simplify, you know, the ETFs like the ones you're offering, simplify this act of, you know, being able to say to a client, okay, I think, you know, we can swap this ETF over here, or part of this holding in favor of this holding. So how do you begin, like, if you start from a 60-40 that has even, let's say, already a small allocation to alternatives, where, like, what are some of the moves do you think that would be building that, you know, beginning to actually start to build some meaningful resilience into the portfolio, into a model portfolio?
Yeah, I would say the good news is, and again, this transcends just the time period we're in today. I'm never a big fan of making like massive changes to a portfolio. I mean, if we're at the depths of like the financial crisis and there's screaming opportunity, sure. Yeah. But anytime there's a lot of uncertainty and we're at the top of the market, what feels like could be the top of the market, I think making like wholesale changes in the portfolio will probably not benefit you, because ultimately then now you're making a market call. So how can we like fine tune or make some tweaks?
I've made that mistake, by the way. So, yeah. You know, I made the mistake in 2003. Not the thing itself was not the mistake, trade. Yeah. But the approach that I took to make my clients understand why they needed to make the change really upset quite a few clients.
Yes.
Which was that, you know, I went from having sort of a long-term attitude towards equity ownership, you know, buy and hold, like sort of a Warren Buffett type of mindset that, you know, we could own great companies. But even though companies are great, that doesn't mean the stocks are good any longer. Like, you know, if you own something at the top of the market, it's still a fantastic, like NVIDIA is a fantastic company by all standards, you know, in terms of what they're doing. But is the price the right price?
Yep.
Right? Like maybe it's a little bit better today, but the mistake I made was that when I came at my clients, it was to sell a substantial portion of their equities in favor of zero coupon bonds.
Yep.
And, you know, that trade turned out to be great. I hope that they stuck with it from then till now, you know, with their new advisor. But you know, they probably might have, it, you know, long zero coupon bonds. Well, turned out to be fantastic, but it doesn't matter whether you're right or wrong. It's you know, how do you go about doing it? And I should have been more gradual. When I look back in hindsight, I should have taken a more gradualistic attitude and approach to introducing the topic and making the moves.
Yeah, and I think too, what it does is, from a psychology perspective, is if we, let's say I'm an advisor and I'm making wholesale changes in my portfolio, I'm conditioning my client to be supportive and maybe even suggest wholesale changes on their end as well. So when we have our clients coming to us saying, I want to get all out of this and I want to get into this and I want, like, and the advisor saying, like, you're crazy. You don't know what you're talking about. Like, I always flip the table and say, like, how many advisors have I seen firsthand that have done the same thing, where it's like, we're making a huge duration call. We are getting out of equities. We're getting all into equities. And so I think the more level set that the advisor can remain and prudent and conditioning their clients to understand long-term objectives and staying in the market and staying focused on those kind of those goals, which might not hit for 5, 10, 15 years, we're creating an environment where the client will start behaving in a way that's more supportive to kind of staying on track.
You kind of want to be, you want to middle it, right? You want to be kind of in the middle. If this happens, then, you know, this will help that. If that happens, then it'll be this. But you kind of want to maintain a very level approach and a level head about why you're making the changes,
so,
or
like,
any changes.
Show your client how you want them to act as well. So if you're being erratic and making massive portfolio changes, you can't be surprised when they want to as well. You're conditioning them in that way. I think another way that, so again, going back to the question of like, how do you then approach, you know, making changes, being more diversified today. I don't think it has to be, it doesn't have to be massive, right? Let's say right now, just for simplicity's sake, you're thinking about a 60-40 portfolio, carve out, you know, 10% from fixed income, 10% from equity. That's 20% now in alts. It might seem like a lot, but it's really not. And then think about being diversified within that kind of alternative sleeve. I would also say another way that clients can make a change in their portfolio that might be less drastic, at least from like look like the line items in their portfolio that they have to review with their clients, is finding strategies that have embedded active management within them or embedded multi-asset solutions within them.
Right.
And this goes well beyond what, you know, Simplify offers. A lot of our peers have really innovative solutions that will combine what they call, I think, you know, Corey Hofstein and team, like the return stacking element, having kind of these overlays where you can get exposure to beta and then have, say, Bitcoin on top of it, or exposure to equities and then have some quantitative alternative right. strategies within a single wrapper ticket. I think that's a really helpful way, especially for the advisors who either their policies don't allow them to explicitly invest in what might be just a pure alternative allocation, or, which is probably even a bigger concern, a lot of advisors, clients, you find the one line item every quarterly meeting that underperformed, and then you focus 45 minutes of your hour-long meeting on that one line item. So having, and again, it's not to hide what's going on. It's giving exposure in a way that's more digestible. And so I think that's another easy, low-hanging fruit way for clients that are looking to move the needle, add diversification, but either policies or preferences don't allow them at this point to have them as a standalone.
Yeah. They can also be strategies that include or incorporate a dynamic management aspect within their output.
Yeah. And that's kind
to
of
your
what
point
I
earlier. Yeah.
Yeah. What I mentioned earlier is like, we're a huge fan of being dynamic. We have strategies that think about how to dynamically lever. So we talked at the very onset of our conversation today about some of these double, triple levered strategies. Well, if you do the research, you'll find every asset class has a unique leverage profile that is optimal. And I'm making these numbers up, but for equities, it might be 4 times. For fixed income, it might be 2 times. For Bitcoin, it might be 7 times. And so if you're able to have a model that allows you to be dynamic based on signals, that's another way to think about being diversified and getting kind of in and out of certain strategies as the markets or shifting trends change, but doing so in a single ticker as well. And then also going back to my comment on commodities, is an asset class like commodities, the common pitfall and why a lot of people don't hold it in their portfolio anymore is it can be prolonged to underperformance for extended periods. So if you have a strategy that can get into commodities and get out of commodities and you don't have to do anything, you know, so whether you want to call it being dynamic, being tactical, outsourcing that to the asset manager, letting them drive that in a single, you know, ETF solution for you allows you to take your hands off the wheel and focus on what's important with your clients.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of advisors are becoming more and more familiar with these instruments as time goes on, and we're trying to do our bit to bring up the knowledge and you know, these dynamic products, you know, dynamic solutions, like for example trend following solutions, they are misunderstood. I think your point was that you know, the reason, you know, they get painted with the same brush or with a bad brush sometimes is because they have some periods of bleed.
Yep.
Where you know, it's costing in performance to own them. And that's that line item that the, you know, the end client turns around and says, well, you know, you said we were going to have, you know, this diversification from this, but it's done nothing but bleed returns while we owned it. And then, you know, but if and when those periods come, when those types of assets do what they were intended to do, you know, display the asymmetric or convex return, all of a sudden it's like, wow, it's thank God we own these things.
Yes.
You know, but until
you own them before it happens.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, managed futures, again, it goes back to communicating and setting expectations with your clients. Managed futures have delivered in every crisis that we've had over the last major 4. So going back to the tech bubble, GFC, COVID in 2022, managed futures have outperformed stocks and bonds.
Yeah. I mean, it's a greatly underappreciated opportunity.
Absolutely. Yeah. But if you focus on one time period where they were challenged, which is in that post-GFC, you know, 2010 to 2019, everybody kind of shed them and said, hey, they're not working for me. Well, The goal is not to outperform equities. The goal is to be a ballast or a diversifier to equities. And equities went up, up, and up. So again, it's about the expectation in the portfolio.
And it's not to incorporate or think about these any of these types of diversifiers in isolation.
Correct.
They should always be examined in the context of a portfolio.
Yes, absolutely agree with that.
Right?
Yep.
Paisley, what an incredible conversation.
Yeah, this was super fun. I love this. I mean, just to have a free-flowing conversation about things that are near and dear to my heart, but I think are also really important for advisors broadly right now. So I really appreciate you guys having me on, and we hope to have Simplify back soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight.
Thanks, Pierre.